You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa broke ground at a new cell phone tower last week as part of a nationwide public safety network. We'll talk to the project leader to learn more about the new tower and its role in emergency response. First, let's say you're watching TV when all of a sudden the local meteorologist comes in and starts talking about severe weather in the area. If the bad weather's happening wherever you happen to be, you're probably grateful for the info. But if it's sunny and calm outside your living room window and you're really into the show you're watching, do you get a little annoyed? Just recently, some people in Ohio got really worked up when meteorologist Jamie Sampson of Fox 45 in Dayton broke into an episode of The Bachelorette during a tornado warning, only he wasn't having any of it.
I was just checking social media. We have viewers complaining already. Just go back to the show. No, we're not going back to the show, folks. This is a dangerous situation, okay? It's nice, right? Think about this was your neighborhood. I'm sick and tired of people complaining about this. Our job here is to keep people safe, and that is what we're going to do. Some of you complain that this is all about my ego. Stop, okay? Just stop right now. It's not. I'm done with you people. I really am. This is pathetic.
This wasn't an isolated incident. A meteorologist in Atlanta said she got death threats for interrupting the Masters golf tournament a few weeks back. So how do meteorologists decide whether to cut in and how are severe weather warnings issued? Chad Franzen is a meteorologist at WSAW-TV in Wausau. He talked to Central Line producer Bill Martins.
Now, you've been in the TV weather business for a long time and have done your share of breaking into programming during bad weather. Have you ever wanted to go off like this guy in Dayton did?
Good old Jamie Sampson. You know, it's one of those things that he finally had it. And he was at his boiling point, and that's just kind of what took over for him that day that he was doing his coverage of tornadoes, which, by the way, that area saw four tornadoes in that time frame when he was breaking into coverage. And I feel like I would probably have done something similar if it had got to that point. And certainly I think every broadcast TV met would want to do that. The only thing I would have ever had any issue with is he's doing that during the time where people need him most. And so I got it. I understand him doing it. You know, that should have been a 5-second hit instead of him going on for a little bit of a tirade.
Right.
You know, I would have liked to have done the same thing, but I probably would have tried to hold off as much as I could until after the fact to get past the situation.
Sure. Now, how many complaints do you typically get when you're doing, as they say in the business, wall-to-wall coverage?
You know, most TV stations are going to have some kind of wall-to-wall coverage, as you mentioned, and those are going to stem from most of the time tornado warnings where you're going to sign on as soon as that tornado warning comes out, and you're going to stay on the air wall-to-wall until that tornado warning is over. So a lot of TV stations have that policy. So in that time frame, most tornado warnings are going to be 15, 30, sometimes 45 minutes. So in that time, you are really, let's say, ruining someone's day or night because of the fact that you're covering up their coverage. Now, in today's day and age, a lot of the times someone can go find that programming back on whatever network they're watching. 15, 20 years ago, those calls would come in and they would stay with you all night long. And there it was a little different situation because you couldn't tell them just to go onto the internet. But usually within that first 5 minutes, the calls are coming and they're going into the newsroom because usually it's an after 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. event. And the newsroom is usually the only 24-hour manned area where those calls come in. So, you know, I feel the pain of the newsroom staff having to answer those calls. But at the same time, we have to do our job. And, you know, keeping someone safe, at least in my opinion, is worth much more than someone being able to watch a show. And in Jamie Simpson's case in Dayton, Ohio, it was The Bachelorette.
Sure. Now, you know, the local stations all have their main channel, or as we called it, you know, the mothership, maybe yep. Two or three secondary channels. So you have, say, you know, 7-1, then you've got 7-2, 7-3, et cetera. Why can't you just run a crawl on the main channel that doesn't stop whatever's on, saying tune into 7-3 or whatever, and do all your wall-to-wall coverage over there?
Well, a lot of the times it depends on how the station's set up. There's even stations now going to .4s and .5s. So it depends on how the station's set up, but most of the time those other channels are not going to be carried on all the different places that the mothership would be. For instance, if you're an ABC, CBS, NBC, or Fox, you're going to be carried on all the cable stations, you're going to be carried on all the satellites, you'd be carried off air on the bigger stream coming off of the antenna, the stick. Now, when you get to the digital channels and the sub-channels, a lot of those are not available on all the different cable systems. They're not available all the time on satellite, and a lot of them are not going to be powerful enough coming off of the stick where they can carry that frequency, that wave, for the entire TV market.
Let me ask you this. There are so many ways to reach people. You know, you've got traditional TV, Facebook Live. Each station seems to have its own app. There are other weather apps, weather radios. How many people still rely on good old-fashioned television during severe weather?
Most of them. And that's the weird thing is, you know, the technology is as good as the technology is going to be. So when you're in severe weather, especially as it's happening, when you get power outages and stuff like that, your cell phone, you know, if it's charged, it's fine. It's the fact that your cell network and also the internet and everything else, those secondary systems will be apt to fail. So we still see a good portion, 75% or so of the audience that's coming in from television because that's the media they're used to. And that's the media that's going to work most of the time.
We're talking with Chad Franzen. He's a meteorologist at WSAW-TV in Wausau. And we're looking at how weather people like Chad decide when to break into coverage for severe weather. A couple of instances of that happening in the news lately in which the audience didn't like that so much. But Chad is saying it's about safety. Safety comes first. You know, most of the time when you're actually breaking into a program, Chad, it's during a tornado warning. Now, talk about how that tornado warning is issued, because it's not you who's actually doing that, right?
Correct. I mean, for the most part, what will happen days out in advance, Storm Prediction Center in Oklahoma starts putting outlooks out to kind of highlight the areas that could possibly have some severe weather. And as those days get closer to those that time frame, those areas become smaller, a little more fine-tuned. So the Storm Prediction Center really starts it all off with those outlooks days in advance. Then as you get into the event, the day of, the Storm Prediction Center and the local National Weather Service office are going to work in coordination with not only getting the watches out, if there is a watch, sometimes a warning comes out without a watch, but most of the time it's with the watch, and then you're going to have the warnings, and the National Weather Service offices are going to coordinate those. And when they issue those are going to be based off of one of two things. For a tornado warning, it's going to be based off of Doppler radar signature, and or it's going to be based off of what someone is seeing out there storm chasing in the field. And so when that information is relayed from the National Weather Service, it goes out to the broadcast media and all the different platforms, cell phones, all that other stuff, and then that'll push the warning out to everybody at home. And that's when we're hopefully on air, if not at that time, shortly thereafter. And a tornado warning for most TV stations are going to hop on as soon as that warning comes out and likely stay on the air until that warning is either expired or canceled.
And I imagine that's got to be a difficult decision for the National Weather Service to put out a watch or a warning, because you want people to be safe. But if you say there's a tornado when there's not really a tornado, you know, they might tune out. But if you wait until you have absolute confirmation, it might be too late for some people. So how do they weigh all of that?
Well, and that's just it. I mean, it's you know, you don't want the false positive as what they're graded on. That's what the National Weather Service and Storm Prediction Center is graded on, is false positive or cry wolf syndrome, if a little more local term that everybody would understand. So they're going to be graded, the National Weather Service at the end of the day will be graded on if they're putting out false positives on those warnings. So there are some metrics in place for at least Doppler radar indicated tornadoes where you have to have so many volume scans, and then you still need the human interaction to go in there and look at it. The radar will put out what's called a TVS, a tornado vortex signature. It kind of is like a hand in the air waving to try to get someone's attention. But when you're in severe weather, the local meteorologist as well as the National Weather Service is watching to see what this storm has been doing in the past, how it's evolving, and how it's going to evolve in the future. Short-term forecasting for severe weather is one of the most nerve-wracking things you can do. You don't want a false positive. You don't want to falsely warn someone. But at the same time, the consequence obviously is dire. And so you need to make sure that people are aware of the situation. And that's why pretty much every TV station, when the tornado warning is issued in that area, they will go on wall-to-wall coverage from the beginning of the warning until the end or until it's canceled.
You know, as a meteorologist, you'd probably love for everyone to take what you and your colleagues say seriously. But maybe you get the forecast wrong once in a while, or there's that false warning every now and then. So as we wrap up here, what's your message to people when it comes to severe weather forecasting or, you know, interrupting programming? What do you want them to know and understand?
Well, you know, the biggest thing about interrupting program is we understand the inconvenience of it. It's an inconvenience to the meteorologist, but at the same time, it is a necessity in making sure people are safe. So when the warnings come out, people should be indoors in their lowest place of their house or building that they're in, or the safest place they can get to. It's not the fact that we're trying to overhype anything. We want everybody to be safe. And if someone gets hurt on your watch as a meteorologist and they're not hearing you, there's nothing worse than that. It also makes the meteorologist understand that not everybody's listening and watching at the same time, but you sure hope the heck they are as you're issuing your warnings and talking about them on TV, bringing it really down to street level on where that tornado could possibly be. And whether it's on the ground or you've got a big funnel cloud that's close to it, a lot of times it's a very ominous sight, and those are the reasons why we have so many different areas and opportunities to try to get people to understand that severe weather can happen with a split second. And when we're on there, wall-to-wall coverage, we're wanting to make sure they are safe as much time as we can give them to be safe from any time a tornado could happen.
Good to talk with you again, Chad. Thanks for helping us out.
Anytime, Mr. Bill.
Chad Franzen is a meteorologist at WSAW-TV in Wausau. He talked with producer Mr. Bill Martins about how meteorologists decide whether to break into programming for severe weather coverage. It's after a viral video of a TV meteorologist in Ohio who scolded viewers who were upset that he interrupted The Bachelorette during a tornado warning. Coming up, we'll learn about a new 300-foot cell phone tower that's being built in northern Wisconsin as part of a nationwide public safety initiative. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new poll shows that 43% of Americans say socialism would be good for the country. We'll talk about what socialism is, why its appeal may be growing, and how it's affecting the presidential race. First, the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians broke ground last week on a new 300-foot cell tower within the boundaries of the tribal reservation. The tower's construction is part of a nationwide multi-billion-dollar initiative that provides more comprehensive broadband access for emergency services. The tower's construction also comes a year after a fatal accident involving a family kayaking around the Apostle Islands that was blamed in part on a lack of cell coverage. Theron Rutna is the IT director for the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians. Theron, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much, Rob.
Well, give us the basics on this project.
The cell tower project began over 15 years ago as an action of the Tribal Council of Red Cliff. It's been attempted several times over the years, and it's been a long, ongoing initiative. 5 years ago, Chairman Bainbridge, of the chairman of the Red Cliff Tribe, brought together an initiative to bring tribal members and tribal employees in front of the newly formed and very active First Responders Network Authority. The tribe had a representation on the FirstNet Tribal Working Group, and has worked since then to essentially bring better first responders communication to our area. When FirstNet put out their request for proposal to build the nationwide cellular network, the bid was won by AT&T. Once AT&T won that bid, FirstNet then put out to all the states to be able to create a state plan or take FirstNet's state plan as to how that network would be built out in their state. As part of that state build-out, the First Responders Network Authority made the decision to put a cell tower here in the Shawamana National Forest area up in Red Cliff to be able to cover a very large dead zone where there was no cellular communication. The tribe basically offered land for that. We had an industrial site capable of a cell tower up by where our old water tower was. And since that became agreed, we then began that work. Chairman Peterson of the Red Cliff Tribe took over championing that when he took office, and we have pushed through the legal and BIA permits to put up a cell tower today. We hope that that is going to be able to cover all of the areas of the reservation, as well as assisting the surrounding towns and the open water around us.
And Theron, you mentioned that dead zone. What did that mean, that lack of connection there for public safety in the area?
Any public safety member that was outside of the coverage of their land mobile radio system anywhere inside of the Schwamigan National Forest and isolated areas of the reservation and the surrounding towns would lose complete contact with dispatch. So they could be out there on their own without being able to talk to anyone either over their radio or for a cell phone coverage. And at that point, they would be essentially lost and unable to assist. With the cell tower being placed, we'll then be able to have redundant coverage for the first responders in the area, as well as the ability for those of us who carry commercial and standard cell phones to be able to contact those first responders.
Right. I understand that this wasn't just an issue for the first responders, but there were a lot of maybe potential emergency calls or searches because somebody just lost connection, their family didn't hear back from them, and because of that lack of connection, they might have made an emergency call that ended up not being an emergency.
Very correct, Rob. With the modern communication method mostly being with the cell phones that we all carry, we expect to be in constant communication with each other. When a family member, a loved one, or a coworker doesn't check in, we all look to see, to our cell phones, to see where they are, how to find them, how to get contact with them. We will call local law enforcement and expect them to be able to respond. But if someone's lost up here on the reservation, out on one of the roads that doesn't have connection, it can be 3 to 6 miles for them to try to make it to where they can call out. Or perhaps if they're badly injured, they may never be found until somebody comes driving by, which could be hours or days later.
Talking to Theron Retina, IT director for the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians, about a new cell tower going up meant to help fill a gap in emergency response and communication. Theron, can you talk about what this means for tribal lands there in particular?
For the tribal lands, only coverage that the tribe has in this area is a small portion that is coming from splash, or basically what can be seen from the Madeline Island Tower that serves Madeline Island and Bayfield. Less than 20% of the reservation is currently has any coverage at all, and what coverage the reservation does have is highly limited. You would not get a good or stable connection even in the best areas. For the reservation, this tower will bring our coverage to nearly 80% of our major populated areas. It will have indoor coverage in all of the major tribal government buildings, as well as cover portions of the town of Bayfield, town of Russell, town of LaPointe, and out onto the lake beyond.
And Theron, I know the focus here is on emergency management and safety issues. Is there going to be a side benefit of now you're connected in places that you didn't used to be?
There will be a very major benefit. The First Responders Network Authority and AT&T allow the commercial bands to go up in these towers, as well as band 14, which is the band specifically dedicated to first responders. When the first responders do not have priority and preemption over that time and that cell traffic, then commercial users on AT&T will be able to use it as well. Because of the planning that the tribe has put in, the tower that's being built will be built with 5 positions for carriers. One position is reserved for the tribe, but the other 4 are available for commercial carriers, the top position being taken up by AT&T with band 14 for the first responders. The other 3 positions will be available to other cellular carriers. The tribe will be approaching other cell carriers that are common to the area to see if they will be willing to put equipment and gear up on that cell tower so that they will have communications as well.
Getting back to the emergency side of things, I mentioned earlier that tragic story, members of a family dying on a kayaking trip around the Apostle Islands. Tragic in part because of the deaths. Also, the mother who did survive had attempted to call and text to get help, but those calls remained unanswered. I understand they were out of coverage. Did this really highlight the potential hazards of not having this communication?
Yes, Rob, this does very much highlight the potential problems and disasters that can occur from this. I will note that the tribe was working on this project long before this tragic incident, because the tribe had recognized that this could be a possibility, especially with the traffic that comes through, with the ice caves, with tourism, and with remote hiking. It's the reason the tribe has been pushing this so hard for so many years.
As you mentioned, this has been 15 years in the making so far. What is the timeline then on having this thing up and in place?
We don't have a current timeline given to us by AT&T due to the difficulties in construction and acquisition of things like steel and other resources. But AT&T assures us that we should have this completed within this fiscal year, and we're hoping to have it up and running by late fall. But again, that timeline is completely tentative and could change based on natural disasters, natural just the weather itself up in the Northland, much less the availability of resources beyond our control.
And you mentioned you've been working on this locally for a long time. This is part of this big national project to fill in gaps just like this. Can you talk about what you've seen on the national level as you've been working on this process?
As a member of the First Responders Network Authority Tribal Working Group, as well as the FCC's Native Nations Task Force and Department of Homeland Security SAFECOM, the tribe is very interested in getting this moved out to other tribal nations as well as to other rural areas. And each of the reservations that I have visited, each of the rural areas that I visited have the same problems that Red Cliff does. In the rural areas of the United States, it's very difficult for us to get communications because it's not commercially viable. The only way for those communications to get in oftentimes is for the federal government to step in and offer money, such as through the First Responders Authority, to be able to cover these areas that would not be commercially viable.
We'll leave it there for now. Theron, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
Theron Rutna is the IT director for the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians. He joined us today to talk about the new 300-foot cell phone tower scheduled to be built within the grounds of the tribal reservation. It's part of a multi-billion-dollar public safety initiative happening nationwide aimed at filling in gaps in coverage, especially for emergency officials and first responders. Coming up, do Americans want a little dose of socialism? Maybe even a bigger dose? We'll look at a new poll on the appeal of socialism, why it appears, at least according to one pollster, to be climbing. You can get started on that conversation right now. Head over to the Ideas Network page on Facebook and let us know what socialism means to you, how you define it, if you want to see it or not in the United States. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, did you ever wonder what it's like to be a professional musician and actually try to make money doing it? Kate Archer-Kent and her guests get the inside story on the business side of the music world. It's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, a recent Gallup poll shows that socialism has gained quite a bit of acceptance in the U.S. over the years. 43% of Americans in that poll say socialism would be a good thing for the country. Back in 1942, 77 years ago, just 25% felt that way. Since 2010, a majority of Democrats have said they view socialism positively, including last year when 57% said so. In fact, according to a new poll from The Hill, Bernie Sanders, a self-described Democratic socialist, has 17% support in a 20-plus candidate race. He trails only Joe Biden at 36%. So why the growing appeal of some form of socialism? Gerald Poder is a professor of history and American studies at Lawrence University in Appledon. Gerald, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
Well, some polling shows that people have a hard time defining socialism, and that's fair. It covers a lot of ground. Can you give us some working definitions of socialism?
Well, of course, that's the big problem. If people are asked, do you support socialism, and they say yes, and they're unable to give a coherent definition of socialism, does it really count? My definition of socialism, and obviously you can't look it up in the dictionary. It actually varies, I think, from individual to individual, but my definition is the ownership by the government of the means of production and the providing by the government of various services such as health care, employment, education, even income that we would normally see from the private sector. So it's a two-sided definition. Ownership by government and running or planning of the economy and providing government services.
And it's not an either or necessarily. There are different nations have had different scales, I guess. One nation might provide Social Security. One might own the auto factory. There's a lot of room for different.
It's definitely a continuum. And for example, in the Scandinavian countries, which are usually cited as examples of socialism, they don't necessarily go all the way. They have a free enterprise, free market system, but the government provides a great deal in the way of services that we do not provide here in the United States. And also, there are very high tax levels to pay for those. So it's a continuum.
When you look at the United States, I know it's polls can be a little opaque sometimes for what people are really looking for. Let's take the first part of your definition. Do you think there's an appetite for state ownership of the means of production for, say, consumer goods, manufacturing, that kind of thing?
My feeling is that there is not. And the emphasis that most democratic socialists place on their program usually is on the second part, the provision of services. They're usually a little vague as to what kind of constraints on free enterprise there will be, because I think they understand that there is a strong individualist, independent impulse in American history, in American society. In fact, what I do is I like to break down American history generally, and even America today, into two competing impulses: an impulse towards independence and individualism. I'm going to make it on my own. Leave me alone. And an impulse of a community, of security. I want the government to help me out with certain aspects of my life. And I think those are two competing impulses in American history. One or the other does not necessarily dominate in a particular period, but one has more influence than the other in some eras of American history. For example, the 1930s, where I think the community security impulse was predominant. In the 1920s and in the 1980s, the age of Reagan, I think it's fair to say that independence and individualism predominated. So I think you're always going to have a push-pull among the American people on that basis. Now, I think what makes our present-day politics unique is that it almost seems that the country is divided almost in half as to those impulses, and then we can see that from these polls on socialism. But that said, I wonder whether the majority of the American people, including the young, who are obviously the most supportive of the idea of socialism, how much they are going to be tolerant of higher taxes and also constraints on their consumption. Even the young who say they want socialism, they also want their Netflix, they also want their Airbnb, they also want their Uber, they want their stuff. You know, they want their Amazon Prime. They want their products delivered in 2 days. I ordered something on a Friday afternoon through Amazon Prime. I'm certainly not young, and I was almost shocked to see that they promised it to me by Sunday morning. Sunday morning. Now, to me, that's a luxury. To many young Americans, that's a necessity. And I wonder if they are going to be that tolerant of a government that restricts free enterprise and restricts their consumption choices. That's what I really, what I really wonder about. So the first part of it, restrictions on capitalism, the restrictions on free enterprise, when push comes to shove, a lot of Americans, I think, are going to be very uncomfortable with that. The second part, the services, that's more popular.
Talking to Gerald Podair, professor of history and American studies at Lawrence University in Appleton, looking at the appeal of socialism, what socialism is, what people think about it, what it might mean here in the United States. And Gerald, a common argument is that there's kind of a slippery slope. You start with some maybe services, but it points in the direction of more and more state control and ultimately tyranny. What do you make of that argument often from conservatives or Republicans in the present day?
Well, that's the classic Republican or classic conservative critique of socialism. There was an economist named Friedrich Hayek who made that point very, very strongly in a famous book called The Road to Serfdom, which came out in the 1940s, where he argued that economic authoritarianism will eventually cause political authoritarianism. And while there is some truth to that, I would caution conservative critics of socialism to have a little more faith in our democratic institutions. As much as we argue as Americans over these issues, and as much as we contest elections, we have a remarkably strong democratic system. Even with what was going on with the Mueller report, we have a very strong democratic system, and I would caution critics of socialism on the right not to equate more government involvement in the economy automatically with tyranny and authoritarianism. This is not Venezuela.
And it seems like it gets confused because socialism and capitalism are more economic systems. Each of them can coexist with different kinds of political systems.
Right. There is nothing in the U.S. Constitution, of course, that says that our economic system should be capitalist or socialist. It's a separate kind of document. So socialism can exist in a democratic system. Now, again, and this is very complicated, I would caution those on the left not to assume that a more aggressively socialist or anti-capitalist political system would not interfere with political freedoms. You know, people can talk about democratic socialism and it comes out of the ballot box, but people who feel that their property is being confiscated are going to be very angry about that and probably use the political system or try to use it to overturn that. So for both the right and the left, I would caution against any apocalyptic predictions or visions for the United States one way or another.
We're talking about socialism, what it is, why, according to some surveys, more Americans view it positively, and how it could affect the race for president. We'll mention that in a few. Gerald Podair is with us, professor of history and American studies at Lawrence University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is socialism a dirty word for you or a possible positive? And what do you mean by it anyway? Do you think a little socialism and which form thereof would be good or bad for the United States? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about socialism. Gerald Podair is with us, professor of history and American studies at Lawrence University in Appleton. You can join in with your comments, your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's go to our callers now. Brad starts us off in Plover. Brad, hi.
Hi. Your guest definition of socialism is the economic model Joseph Stalin instituted, which is actually state capitalism, not the original definition of socialism. I would equate socialism more with the government either running or heavily regulating the commons, which would be things like healthcare, the military, the fire and police department, and education system, whereas production of goods and services would be run more on a co-op model where the workers would have more of a say in the decision-making and partly owning their place of employment instead of just having a fat cat at the top in his appointed board calling all the shots, and the worker is often being exploited or having no say whatsoever. So I would look to someone like Richard Wolff at the website Democracy at Work. He's the top expert in the nation on socialism. Have him as a guest to give a counterpoint to your guest's particular definition.
Brad, thanks a lot for the call. And Gerald, people have different visions for socialism, whether they view it positively or negatively.
Well, they do. And obviously words like cooperative, non-exploitative, those kinds of words are, you know, words that sound wonderful, and I think we can all support that. But of course, the devil is in the details. How are these companies going to be run on an everyday basis? Who will be in charge? I mean, those are the questions that never seem to get answered, and sometimes those questions can go off in directions that none of us want. In other words, I think the real fear in terms of socialism is authoritarianism. How much in the way of freedom is going to be taken away from the average American or the average American worker? In other words, let's take healthcare, which I think is going to be sort of the cockpit, the battleground of these arguments between the right and the left over socialism. Are Americans going to say, well, I don't like my doctor. I would probably choose another doctor if I could, but I'm happy to have a doctor. There are a good number of Americans who, under the present system, do not have a doctor at all. Is that what the average American will say, or will the average American say, I want to be able to choose my doctor, and I'm not going to agree to a plan that is restrictive in that way? I think that's the kinds of arguments that we're going to be having as Americans over socialism, however we define it.
Thanks for that call, Brad. We'll go to Mari now in Milwaukee. Mari, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to ask about, Mari?
I wanted to know if your guest could explain the difference between democratic socialism and a social democracy.
Mari, thanks. Gerald, do you want to take a stab at it?
Well, again, these are words that are sometimes used in very, very different ways. Democratic socialism and social democracy, I'm sure that there are people who will distinguish between the two, but really what we're saying here is we're just reversing the terminology. It means that, at least theoretically, Americans will vote voluntarily for a system where the government will play a much greater role in the managing of the economy and will be responsible for the distribution of basic social services on a state level and not a private level. And I think social democracy and democratic socialism are basically the same thing in that way. Again, if you get someone on who's a member of Democratic Socialists of America, they may distinguish between the two. But I think generally that's the idea.
Thanks a lot for the call, Mari. In our last couple minutes, Gerald, let's talk about that sliding scale again, because it seems like most people are going to agree, not everyone, most people are going to agree that the government has a role in things like public safety, the police, fire, things like that. And I think most people in the United States, you were saying earlier, think private business is better off making Big Macs and cars and things like that. But healthcare, there's a lot of middle ground that, as you said, is going to be the point of debate.
Yeah, it is. And I think usually when liberals and conservatives argue about socialism, they eventually make their way to healthcare. Sometimes it's the first thing they start arguing about, and I think it's really, as I said, going to be the cockpit. When I started taking notes for this interview and I started using examples of arguments over socialism, I noticed that my first two or three were involved the healthcare system. So I think that's really where the first argument, the opening wedge of do we want to be a socialist country, is going to come. It's going to come over health care. And it's interesting because after all the storming and anger and debates and screaming talk show hosts, we still have an Obamacare system that a good number of the people in the United States are, while not completely satisfied with, are maybe I'll just say okay with. And that's interesting, I think, because many on the right would call that a form of socialism.
We'll leave it there for now. Gerald, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Gerald Podair, professor of history and American studies at Lawrence University. We talked with him about socialism and debates over it and polling on socialism in the United States. We looked at a recent Gallup poll that shows 4 in 10 Americans embrace some level of socialism, though definitions may vary. Are you one of those four or not? You could still weigh in with your thoughts over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. A new coffee shop in Stevens Point showcases one of Wisconsin's best roasters. The owner of Ruby Coffee Roasters worked on the West Coast with some of the nation's most prestigious coffee companies. When it came time to start his own business, he did it in central Wisconsin. Rob Mentzer has the story.
They're steaming milk for cappuccinos, but the Ruby Coffee Roasters Cafe hasn't opened its doors yet. They're training new employees.
This is a pretty beefy grinder. I like how this one sounds.
Owner Jared Linsmeyer can't say he isn't nervous about the big new step for his business.
No, I'm absolutely terrified, you know, that we love this idea and that we're going to, like, lose everything on it.
Ruby Coffee is a sensation. Some weeks they roast as much as 4,000 pounds of coffee at their facility in Nelsonville, a tiny town in Portage County. In February, Food and Wine magazine named them the best coffee in Wisconsin. But they've never had a cafe before. Almost all of their business has been through wholesale and online orders. It might seem surprising that the best coffee roaster in Wisconsin is based in the rural center of the state, but Ruby Coffee Roasters really couldn't have been started anywhere else.
For filter, we have five.
Jared is from Stevens Point. After he graduated college in the early 2000s, he moved to Los Angeles, where he got a job working at Intelligentsia Coffee's first West Coast cafe. That's also where he met his future wife, Deanna. When the company started a roastery, Jared became an apprentice. And as he advanced in the world of specialty coffee, he and Deanna moved to Portland and then Seattle. By the time they had their first daughter, they felt like downtown Seattle wasn't the right place to raise their family.
There's nowhere you can take a one-year-old to toddle around and learn how, you know what I mean? Have to hold her hand all the time or she's going to get hit by a truck.
Moving the family to Wisconsin in 2013, just before their second daughter was born, offered them access to family, friends, and a burgeoning food scene in Stevens Point. Deanna had her own business as a consultant to nonprofits, which brought in enough to get Ruby off the ground.
We were living for almost free at the house I grew up in, so that was a huge help. And
because of that really low overhead, we were able to just kind of chip away at startup costs just with the money that I was bringing in.
Small cities and towns in Wisconsin need to attract young entrepreneurs like the Linsmeyers, who are both in their 30s. A 2017 report from the UW-Madison's Applied Population Lab found that only 15% of Wisconsin communities are seeing growth among young adults. The problem is especially acute in rural areas and in the Northwoods. Something else the researchers noted, one of the things young adults said they value the most in a place to live is a good coffee shop. Jared said that in 2019, the desire for specialty coffee is definitely not just a big city thing.
Now there's great coffee in Eau Claire, there's great coffee in Door County, there's great coffee up north.
On the day of the ribbon cutting at the new cafe, the room is filled with supporters and friends. Also there is 90-year-old Grandma Ruby.
I just love the coffee shop and the Ruby Coffee Roaster that he named after me, his grandmother.
Jared and Deanna hold a daughter each as he speaks to the crowd.
Man, so Ruby was just like this dream in 2013. And
Jared was nervous before, but he's feeling good today. They've added 14 people to work at the cafe, and the company now employs 24. Cafe manager Katie Demlow moved back to Wisconsin from Washington, D.C. for the job. They all go outside, and Ruby herself cuts the ribbon. And with that, people walk over to the counter to order some coffee. Rob Mentzer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, it might be a rough season for air travel this year, with some models of planes on hiatus because of safety concerns. An expert on the nation's airline market tells us what to expect when we take to the skies this summer. A new effort in Congress is bringing together a progressive Democrat and a conservative Republican to try to change the rules on lobbying by former senators and congressional representatives. We'll get the details and we'll ask you what you think. And in life, should we focus on being really, really good at one thing or learn lots and lots of different stuff? We'll talk to the author of a new book who says, hey, when you break down the research, the generalists usually come out better than the specialists. We'll find out why that is. That and look at some of the top news of the day. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 6, if you're working on a summer reading list, Kate and her guest are ready to help you. Join the conversation about great summer reads and call in and share your suggestions. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll get you up to speed on what's going on here at Wisconsin Public Radio on the air and behind the scenes. WPR Director Mike Crane joins us for this month's edition of Mondays with Mike. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.